Okay, so picture this. You're sitting at a cafe, you're looking at a coffee cup on the table. Seems simple, right? But what if I told you that you aren't actually seeing the cup? I mean, not in the way you think you are. What you're seeing is basically a projection of what your hand could do to it.
So not a shape, but a potential action.
Exactly. You're seeing graspability, not ceramic. And what if I told you that your memories, every face, every birthday, the smell of your grandma's kitchen, they aren't actually inside your brain?
That's a bit harder to swallow.
Right.
Like,
Like, if we could crack open your skull and look at the atoms with the most powerful microscope ever, we wouldn't find a single memory file.
it sounds like, science fiction, but it's actually the core argument of one of the most brilliant and, let's be honest, difficult philosophical texts from the 19th century.
Today, we are unpacking Henri Bergson's Matter and Memory, specifically his work from 1896 and that intro he wrote in 1911. And I gotta be honest, when I first picked this up, I thought, okay, 1890s philosophy, this is gonna be dusty.
And it's not.
It is so not. It's startlingly relevant. It completely flips the script on how we think about the mind.
It's a truly radical text. I mean, Bergson is trying to solve the ultimate headache, the mind-body problem.
The classic dilemma.
Yeah.
We have this meat machine in our skulls, the brain. And then we have this intangible thing we call mind or consciousness. And nobody really knows how they connect.
Right. How does a firing neuron become the taste of chocolate? And usually people just pick a side. You've got the realists who say, it's all matter. The brain is everything. The mind is just an illusion.
The ghost in the machine isn't real.
Exactly. And then you have the idealists who say, no, matter is the illusion. Everything is just a construct of the mind.
And Bergson steps into the ring and basically tells them both, you're both wrong.
He says they're both missing the point because they start from the same bad assumption, that perception is about knowing the world. Like our eyes are just tiny cameras.
But he flips that completely.
He does. He says, perception isn't about knowledge, it's about survival. It's all about action.
Okay, so let's get into the machinery here. Because to understand his theory on memory, which is, the really mind-blowing part, we have to start with what he thinks matter even is. He uses this term, images.
And we have to be super careful here because image to us means like a photo, a JPEG.
Right.
For Bergson, it's something way more fundamental. He says the entire universe, all of matter, is an aggregate of images. And an image is something halfway between a thing and a representation.
Okay, let's unpack that a little. That sounds pretty abstract.
Think about the chair you're sitting on. Does it exist if you get up and leave the room?
I mean, I would hope so. Otherwise, I'm in for a surprise when I come back.
Right. A realist says, of course it does. It's an object. An idealist might say, well, it only exists as an idea in a mind. Bergson says the chair is an image. It has its own existence. It acts on other images, like the floor or the light hitting it, whether you're there or not.
So the whole universe is just this giant soup of images interacting with each other.
A vibrating interactive reality,
Right.
exactly. But there's one image in that whole soup that's special. It changes the game. Everybody.
Your body.
He calls it a privileged image, which it sounds a bit fancy, but he just means it's functionally different.
Totally. It's privileged because you know it from the outside. You can look at your hand, but also from the inside, through sensation, through what he calls affection.
And this leads to the first big aha moment for me. Bergson says the body acts like a filter, a really, really aggressive one.
This is his screen theory. And it's so crucial. We usually think our senses are trying to soak in as much reality as possible. It gives a full 4K picture.
Like a camera recording the whole room.
Exactly. But Bergson says no. If you actually perceived everything, every light wave, every atomic vibration, you'd be completely paralyzed by the data. You couldn't function.
So our nervous system isn't an adder, it's a subtractor.
It's a bouncer at a club. Its main job is to block out 99.9% of reality. It only lets in the information that is relevant to what your body can do. Like, what can I eat? What might kill me? What can I walk on?
Precisely. And that's why he calls perception virtual action. When you look at that coffee cup, your brain isn't analyzing its atomic structure. It's highlighting the handle because you can grab it. It's mapping your possible actions onto the world.
Wow. So we don't see things as they are. We see them as we are, or as we can use them.
It creates a map of potential. And the more complex your nervous system is, the more potential you have. An amoeba perceives very little because it can only do a couple of things.
This helps with the difference between perception and sensation, which he calls affection. I always just kind of lump them together.
But for Bergson, they're opposites. Perception is virtual action. It happens at a distance. You see the fire. You can move toward it. It's a menu of options.
But if I actually stick my hand in the fire,
then it's not virtual anymore. That is real action. The fire is acting on you. Your body can't reflect the energy back, so it has to absorb it. And that forced absorption, that's pain.
So pain is a failed action.
A local, unavailing effort. It's your body trying to repel something and failing. So perception is your zone of freedom. Pain is your limit.
Okay, so the body is a center of action, a filter. But this brings us to the elephant in the room, the brain. If the body is just filtering, what is the brain actually doing? I was always taught the brain creates my thoughts.
And this is where Bergson just goes to war with the materialists of his day and, you know, ours too. He flat out rejects the idea that the brain generates ideas or memories. He uses this metaphor of the central telephonic exchange.
A switchboard.
Think about what a switchboard operator does. They connect a call from point A to point B. They don't create the conversation.
They don't write the script.
They just wrap the traffic. The brain analyzes sensory input and selects a motor output. It chooses a path. Do I run? Do I fight? Do I grab the cup? It's a machine for movement, not a container for consciousness.
He has that amazing image in the text. If you could shrink down and walk inside a living brain, what would you see?
You'd see atoms dancing, chemical reactions, electrical impulses, just movement. But you would never, ever find a memory. You wouldn't find the image of your childhood home or the concept of justice.
It's like watching actors on a stage, but being deaf. You see all the gestures, the mechanism, but you miss the entire meaning of the play.
That's a perfect analogy. The brain is the organ of pantomime. It handles the mechanics.
Okay, but hold on. If the brain is just a conductor, a fancy switchboard, where are my memories? I mean, if they're not in my neurons, where the heck are they?
And this is the most radical part of the whole book. Bergson says we are confusing two totally different things and just calling them both memory. He splits them into habit memory and pure memory.
Okay, let's drill into that. Habit memory, what is it?
Habit memory is body memory. It's not really remembering the past. It's more like acting it out. Think about learning to ride a bike or drive a car.
Right. I don't think about the pedals. My body just...
That's a motor mechanism. It's a habit you've built through repetition, and it's stored in your body. It's useful for navigating the present. But then there's pure memory.
And that's the other kind.
That's the memory of the spirit. He uses that word spirit to mean the mind independent of the body. Pure memory is the actual record of your history. So habit memory is knowing how to drive. Pure memory is remembering that one specific road trip in 2015 when it rained and you stopped at that gas station.
That one moment in time that happened once and is gone.
Yes. And pure memory, he says, records everything, every detail of every second. It preserves the past in its entirety.
Wait, everything? Because I definitely don't remember what I had for lunch three Tuesdays ago. If it records everything, why can't I access it?
Bergson would say you do have that memory, but your brain is actively blocking it.
The bouncer again.
Why would you need to remember that lunch to survive right now? It's not useful for action. So the brain inhibits it. It keeps the door to the past shut so you can focus on the present.
This totally explains dreams, doesn't it?
Spot on. When do we see pure memory flood in? When we sleep. When the body relaxes, when we're not trying to act on the world, the bouncer takes a break, the valve opens, and all these random, vivid, often useless images from the past just come rushing in.
That makes so much sense. Dreams are just the brain's filter shutting down for a bit.
Exactly. The brain's main job is to keep us fixed on the now. When that focus slips, the then floods back in.
Okay, but here's the tricky part. If these memories are just sort of floating around in the spirit, how do we actually pull them up when we need them? How do I recognize your face or understand what you're saying right now?
This gets us into what is honestly the most fascinating part of the book, the motor diagram.
I love that concept. It sounds like an architectural blueprint.
It kind of is. Bergson says recognition always starts with movement. Always. When you're listening to me speak, you aren't just passively letting sound waves hit your eardrum.
I'm interpreting them.
You're physically reconstructing them. Your body, in a very subtle, microscopic way, is mimicking the movements needed to make the sounds I'm making. You are sketching a motor diagram of my speech.
So I'm basically lip-syncing you from the inside.
In a way, yes. You're tracing the physical curve of the thought that creates a shape, a kind of scaffold. And once that scaffold is built, your pure memory throws images at it to fill it in. That's when you understand.
It's a loop.
It's a circuit. Perception happens, the body sketches a diagram, memory projects onto the diagram, and boom, you have meaning. It happens in milliseconds.
That explains why learning a foreign language is so hard.
Yes. Think about it. When you hear a language you don't know, it just sounds like noise, a continuous stream. Because you can't sketch the diagram, you don't know the motor patterns for those syllables, so the sounds have nothing to hook onto.
There's no hook for the memory to grab.
Right. And reading is the same. Bergson calls it divination. You don't read every letter. You catch a few shapes, that's the diagram, and your memory projects the rest of the word onto the page. It's why you don't notice typos half the time. Your memory corrects reality for you.
Okay, so this is an incredible theory, but where are the receipts? I mean, Bergson didn't just make this up. He dives into medical case studies, right? Aphasia.
This is where he really tries to prove his point.
Right.
At the time, the common theory was that if you had aphasia, say, you couldn't understand a word, it was because the specific brain cells storing that memory were destroyed.
The hard drive was corrupted, file deleted.
Exactly. But Bergson looks at the studies and says, no, that's not what's happening. He points out that many of these patients haven't actually lost the memory. Sometimes, in a dream or an emotional outburst, the word comes out perfectly.
So the file is still there.
The file is there. What's broken is the access mechanism. The brain damage has destroyed the ability to create that motor diagram we were just talking about.
They can't build the scaffold.
They can't sketch the sound. And if you can't sketch the sound, the memory has nowhere to land. It can't actualize. It's like having a movie projector ready to go, but the screen has been torn down.
There's that incredible detail about Ribot's Law. I had never heard of this before, but it's about the order in which we forget things.
This is the smoking gun for Bergson. In progressive amnesia, memory loss follows a very specific pattern. You forget proper names first, then common nouns, then adjectives. And the very last things to go are verbs.
Why verbs last?
Because verbs are actions. To run, to eat, to climb. Your body knows how to do these things. They are imitable. They're woven into your motor system.
They're closest to the body.
And proper names, like John or London, are the most abstract. They're just labels or the furthest thing from bodily action.
That is absolutely mind-blowing.
Yeah.
The memories that stick around the longest are the ones your body can actually act out.
Which proves, for him, that the brain and body are just the anchor. They're the mechanism for pulling memory down from the spirit into the present. If the anchor breaks, the most abstract memories drift away first. If memory was just data in cells, there's no logical reason why a John neuron would be more fragile than a run neuron.
It really changes how you look at something like Alzheimer's. It's not necessarily that the library's burning down. It might be that the librarian just can't find the books anymore.
Or the door to the library is stuck. The mechanism is breaking, but the past itself, the past might still be there, intact.
Yeah, that's a hopeful and kind of haunting thought.
And it leads to his grand synthesis. We are dual beings. We have this physical mechanism, the body and brain, that handles the present moment. It's obsessed with utility, with action. And then we have this vast, deep reservoir of spirit or memory that contains everything we've ever been.
And the brain is just the point of contact.
It's the knife edge where the past pushes into the future. The brain's only job is to keep our attention fixed on life so we can keep moving forward.
So it forces us to live in the now by constantly suppressing the then. It filters the massive weight of our own history so we can just cross the street.
Precisely. But, and here's the real kicker, if Bergson is right and memory is not contained in the brain.
Then when the brain dies?
Well, think of it like a radio. If you smash a radio, the music stops. But the broadcast signal doesn't stop. The receiver is broken, but the signal is still there. Bergson doesn't get overtly religious here. But his logic opens a very clear, rational door to the idea that the spirit might be independent of matter.
We aren't just biological machines.
We're something larger, sort of squeezed into a biological machine for a while to act on the world.
I am going to be thinking about that motor diagram concept all day. The idea that to understand something, I first have to physically mimic it. It makes listening feel like a workout.
It makes you realize how active perception really is. You're never just a passive observer. You're always participating.
Something to mull over next time you can't find your keys. Are you forgetting, or is your body just refusing to sketch the diagram for keys?
Or maybe the bouncer just decided those keys weren't relevant to your immediate survival.
Very convenient. Well, thanks for taking this deep dive into the weird and wonderful world of Henri Bergson with us. It's dense, but man, it really changes how you see everything.
It was a pleasure. It's one of those books that rewires your brain. Or at least it rewires your motor diagrams.
Take care of your motor diagrams, everyone. We'll see you on the next deep dive.